long so that it is easy to put everything away. How to organize anything. I recommend the book Organizing for Dummies by Eileen Roth and Elizabeth Miles for learning how to organize your space for optimal efficiency and effectiveness. The authors provide suggestions for organizing every room of your house. Best of all, their system centers on a set of 5 simple principles based on the acronym PLACE that you can use to organize anything effectively. I found these principles to be useful time and again. Here they are. Purge. Get rid of what is unnecessary, especially pens that don't work. Like with like. This means that you group like things together just as you learned in high school English. This is the central principle to organizing anything. Access. When you have your groupings determined, place them according to your access needs. This is why, for example, extra supplies go off in a supply closet or other out-of-the-way place rather than in your drawers. You don't want things you don't use often getting in your way when accessing things you do need a lot. Contain. Don't just let items run loose. Use drawer dividers and other types of containers to organize items. Evaluate. When you are done organizing, step back and contemplate the results and make sure your new setup works well for you. Make any adjustments. Your workspace, creating a high-performing workflow system. Setting up your workspace and desk well matters for several reasons. First, when you have your desk set up well, you minimize resistance so that you can give your focus and energy to doing your work. Second, you will work better if you have your desk set up well and know how to use it. A desk is a workflow system. Therefore, you ought to approach it with intentionality and purpose. You can be more effective when you understand your tools and know how to make the most of them. After all, your desk is the place where you must complete important tasks every day. Third, when your desk is not set up well, the clutter creates drag and thus drains time, energy, and focus. I like how the authors of Organizing for Dummies put it. You don't need to be an efficiency expert, interior designer, or feng shui master specializing in the Chinese art of placement to know that the right workspace can set you up for success, while a whatever approach to your workplace layout can sap your time, energy, concentration, and creativity. Or, to say it another way, clutter sucks creativity and energy from your brain. Fourth, when you make it easy to act, you will do more. As Kerry Gleason, author of The Personal Efficiency Program, says, most people act when it's easy to do so. The better organized you are, the easier it is to act, and the greater the tendency for you to do those things that should be done, when they should be done. Fifth, you use your desk almost every day, and knowing how to use it is not hard to figure out. So the benefits you get from this are large, while the cost involved is minimal. Sixth, work is more fun when you know how to use your desk. A well-run desk is a work of art. You can read the full series of how to set up your desk and workspace on my blog. Here are a few key principles. 1. Your workspace should be like a cockpit. You want it to be an effective, efficient home base for dealing with stuff and executing work. Thus, it needs to be lean and function with ease. You want to be able to move quickly with minimal drag. 2. You should have fingertip access to the things that you use and do most often, and enough surface area to do your work and create temporary groupings as needed on the desktop, which you clear away when done. 3. Clear space is good. Do not aim to occupy every fragment of space. A desk is for working, not storing things. So be a minimalist when it comes to what you keep on your desk permanently. 4. Everything at your desk falls into just a few categories: equipment, supplies, decoration, reference, transient stuff. 5. The desk is for doing work, not storing work or reminding you of work. 6. Creation of centers are necessary, On your desktop, the key centers will likely be the phone center, computer center, tool center, and work center. In your drawers, centers include writing center, mailing finance center, if needed, and stapler filing center. In your files, the major divisions or centers are pending, projects, operations, reference, and archive. 7. Have interchangeable centers at home and work. Chapter 20. Getting projects unstuck. There are lots of reasons projects get stuck, and there are lots of ways to get them unstuck. One of the most powerful ways to getting them unstuck that I've found is applying the natural planning model that David Allen outlines in Getting Things Done, The Art of Stress-Free Productivity. The key to this process is first defining your purpose for the project. This is how our mind naturally wants to operate, hence the phrase natural planning model. Unfortunately, we tend to default to the opposite approach. We try to come up with a good idea before having a clear purpose and vision. Taking this approach almost always creates increased ambiguity and thus stress, because there is no unifying principle to integrate things. The result is that you can easily go off in 1,000 directions without ever even hitting on the actions that you really need to take. But when you define the purpose first, it immediately gives you clarity, guidance, and focus. Because you have focus, you save time. Because you have clarity, you are able to determine the actions that will actually work. And because you have guidance, you won't feel lost and confused. Here is the natural planning model in a nutshell. The 5 steps of the natural planning model. Purpose and principles. Step 1 is defining the why of the project. If you are redesigning the website of your organization, for example, why are you doing that? Are you seeking to increase usability, replace an outdated design, or add new functionality? And why are you seeking to do those things? Identifying the steps you need to take on a project is much easier when you know why you are doing it in the first place. And, as Simon Sinek points out in Start With Why, starting with the purpose is also the key to motivating and inspiring people. Those who are able to inspire give people a sense of purpose or belonging that has little to do with any external incentive or benefit to be gained. People who are inspired act because they want to, not because they have to. And this inspiration comes not from external incentives, but from purpose. Principles are the core standards for how you will do things. They are inspiring when they resonate with the core of people and are based on the desire to empower people rather than control them. Outcome visioning. After defining the purpose, you then start envisioning what it will be like to achieve success with the project. This is the what. For example, to use a wild and crazy idea, if the project is to accomplish a manned mission to Mars, the vision of the outcome might be 4 people have landed safely on the red planet and are ready to walk around and explore. The world is excited by this incredible new step. The visitors will stay for 2 months and then return. Or, if your company is looking for a new office building, your vision might be, we are in a building with excellent design that is inspiring and doesn't make us feel like we are back in the 1940s. There is enough room for all our employees and many years of growth. The building is near good restaurants and has sufficient parking. Brainstorming. Envisioning the outcome naturally leads to generating ideas regarding how you are going to achieve your goal. What actions do you need to take in order to make it happen? You might need to identify the budget, find a realtor, narrow down the parts of town you want to consider, and so forth. Organizing. Then, these actions need to be organized, organizing them into groupings of similar components, such as design, legal, search, and so forth, can be helpful. Next actions. Finally, you determine the very next thing you need to do to get the project going. Utilize this process whenever you want to improve or create something. I was doing a coaching session with an executive recently. When I asked him the main thing in his work or life that he wanted to improve, he said, leading his family. That's an excellent decision. So I took him through this process. We talked about why he wanted to lead his family more effectively. Then we talked about what this would look like and the benefits it would have for his family. Then we talked about what recurring habits and actions would be best to put in place to make this happen. The number of ideas this process generated and the amount of clarity it brought to the task was amazing. Just by using this simple process, we had a tool for creating powerful change and improvement in this executive's life. Chapter 21. Overcoming the number one sticking point for new leaders. High performers are often elevated to the executive level and then left to figure out on their own how to operate successfully in their new roles. Scott Eblin. It is possible for a focus on personal productivity to ruin your ability to lead. One of the most helpful books I've read on leading in an organization is Scott Eblin's The Next Level. Eblin points out that 40% of new executives fail within 18 months of being named to their positions. That's an incredible statistic. A typical response might be that this is just the Peter principle at work, which states that people have been promoted to their level of incompetence. But I think Eblin is right, that this theory actually doesn't make much sense. Most of these people are talented, bright, and motivated. It is unlikely that such a high percentage of them have been promoted beyond their ability. What is actually going on is that these people are making a classic, but very easy to understand, mistake. When they got into their new leadership positions, they kept doing all the things that got them there. They didn't realize that leadership is a different sort of thing than management, and even more significantly, than being an individual contributor. And so, they failed. They acted like an individual contributor in a leadership role, and so they ended up doing all the wrong things. They probably even did them extremely well, for it was their capacity for individual contribution that likely got them promoted to a level of more formal leadership. But since they were doing the wrong things, it backfired and undermined their effectiveness in the role. Don't confuse the roles of the producer and the leader. Much of the time, people reach positions of formal leadership because they have proven themselves as fantastic individual contributors. They have done excellent work coding pages for the website, an individual contributor task, for example. And so, they become promoted to head up the whole web division, a leadership task. The problem is that at the higher levels of an organization, you don't succeed primarily because of your abilities as an individual contributor, that is, because of your abilities to do the work. Rather, your primary role now is to set direction, align your team, and give thought to the direction of the whole organization. If you keep focusing on doing the work yourself, or acting like another member of the team whose contribution is simply another chunk of work that is the same in kind as what everyone else is doing, you will be neglecting the things you have been put in your position to do. In fact, and this is the key, if you keep trying to do the sorts of things you did as an individual contributor, you simply won't have time to lead at all. The main takeaway you need to get here is that you have to stop doing some good things in order to lead well. If you keep trying to do your functional responsibilities, you simply won't have time to lead. Your individual contribution tasks will interfere with your leadership tasks. There is a range here, of course. It's not that the leader has no responsibilities as an individual contributor. The leader's primary area of focus needs to be leadership tasks, not individual contributor tasks. Leadership, setting down responsibility for a few results and picking up accountability for many results. Eblin talks about 8 core things that you need to stop doing and 8 things you need to start doing to succeed at the executive level. His most helpful point is that executive leadership requires setting down responsibility for few results and picking up accountability for many results. To be responsible for something is to be involved in the details. You are either doing it directly or closely involved in directing those who are. Obviously, if you are closely involved with the details of things, you won't have the time to deal with a lot of things. To be accountable, on the other hand, is to be answerable for the results that other people, your team, achieve. Since you aren't involved with the details doing things, you can be accountable for many things, which is exactly what any leadership role requires. Leaders need to accomplish more than they did as individual contributors, not less. And that's the precise reason they need to stop acting like individual contributors. As an individual contributor, your efforts don't scale. But when you lead, your efforts are multiplied through the influence you have on the contributions of others. Thus, you need to spend less time on individual projects and more time working across the scope of the organization, or, if your role is informal, the movement. This means, as Andy Stanley has said, that if you are a leader, you need to spend the majority of your time at the 30,000-foot level while remaining accessible to team members who are closer to the action. Spend more time strategizing and less time problem-solving. How getting things done can inadvertently prevent you from leading. How does getting things done inadvertently prevent you from leading? It's simple. The project lists and action lists involved in most productivity approaches, such as GTD, tend to cause your focus to gravitate to your own individual contribution. When looking at your next actions, for example, it's easy to fall into the notion that, I'd better do these things. Since it's often easier and quicker to do these things ourselves at first, we end up settling into an individual contributor model when we should be thinking more broadly about our team and the culture of the entire organization. And this is especially the case if you work for an organization that might be perennially short-staffed, such as a nonprofit or a ministry. That is exactly what happened to me. At one time, I was leading 3 departments in our organization. I was managing the church and conference bookstores, launching our nationwide radio program, and leading our web department. This was a lot to have going on at once. I was frequently pulling all-nighters, which I actually enjoy. And I disagree with those who say that an all-nighter is a sign that you are inefficient and can't get your work done. Not true. And one week, I pulled 3 all-nighters in a row, my personal record. The biggest reason for these long hours and all-nighters, aside from the fact that I really enjoyed what we were doing, is that I was doing a lot of work myself. I had a team of a few people in each area, but didn't have nearly the number of people I needed. So I filled this gap by doing a lot of the work right along with my team. I even put up a line of slat wall for shelving on the north wall of our bookstore all by myself. As anyone who has put up slat wall knows, that is a 2- or 3-person job. Doing it by yourself is ridiculous. Now, leaders should sometimes, frequently even, pitch in directly by working alongside the people on their teams. But this shouldn't be the main thing leaders do. They need to be setting direction, looking ahead, and aligning people. I don't want to be too hard on myself here. In a very real sense, due to the small number of people I had to work with, I simply had no other choice. But the size of my team wasn't the only reason for all these hours I was putting in. The other reason was that I simply thought this was what it meant to do my work. I knew that leading my teams was important, but no one had ever told me that to do this well, or alternatively, keep my sanity, I had to stop doing so much of the work myself. So I worked 80 to 90 hour weeks and pulled these frequent all-nighters. Utilizing GTD, getting things done, only contributed to my working so many hours. It's certainly not the fault of GTD, but I thought of 100 next actions and 50 projects as something I must do rather than things to delegate. This is not an intrinsic defect of GTD itself. Rather, the fault comes in how we use it. If we aren't aware of this danger, many of us, myself included, are likely to fall into this overwork trap. So, how do we avoid falling into the trap and instead use getting things done to enhance our leadership? Adapting getting things done for leadership. There are two main ways to adapt GTD for leadership. Delegation. The first way to adapt GTD for leadership is to have the right mindset. We need to avoid overloading ourselves with next actions we need to personally do and projects we need to personally execute. This comes in part from making proper use of delegating. Sometimes this means giving people one-off tasks that come our way. This is an important thing to do, but we need to be careful of allowing this to devolve into gopher delegation, just telling people what to do, as opposed to delegating responsibilities. The most effective approach to delegation for a leader, though, is to delegate entire areas of responsibility rather than one-off tasks as they come. This is much more effective because you don't need to be in the details. It also cuts off many tasks from even coming to you in the first place and needing to be delegated specifically. By delegation, you can decrease the number of specific tasks you have to deal with, thus keeping more time free for true leadership tasks. Project and organizational dashboard. The second approach is the most exciting. This means instead of just creating a roles checklist for yourself, you create an organizational chart for your department, or if you are in top management, your whole organization. Then, every week or so, review the organizational chart and consider what actions you can proactively take to keep things going in the right direction, or to help make someone more effective, and so forth. This is the type of thing you are probably doing already in your head anyway. But creating a checklist or visual chart brings a level of proactive intentionality to it. Reviewing the organizational chart visually can be helpful to come up with new ideas and to identify things you might not otherwise have thought of. To keep this in motion, you can create a weekly repeating task or integrate it into your weekly review. Lead wherever you are. Now, there are many different types of leadership roles, and as Mark Sanborn has pointed out, you don't even need a title to be a leader. So leadership doesn't equate to having a role on the top leadership team, or even necessarily having any formal authority at all. That is a form of leadership, and the main form we have been focusing on so far, but it is not the only kind of leadership. Leadership, at its essence, is influence. And, therefore, you can lead wherever you are. And the leadership principles I've set forth are still important, even if you are not in a formal leadership role in your organization. Because leading where you are involves more than just doing your work. You need to look outward, develop networks, motivate people, and rally them to a better future. You need to do these tasks beyond your individual work if you are an individual contributor. Which means you need to be careful about the tendency to get pulled into a narrow focus on your own work. 5 tips for leaders. Make the good of others your primary aim. The main principle of productivity is to work for the good of others, and leadership has the same aim. Leadership is not about you. It is about serving others, building them up, and making them more effective. We should lead this way because it is right, and it is the way the scriptures teach us to lead. Matthew 20 verses 25 through 28 and 1 Peter 5 verses 1 through 3, etc. Moreover, it is actually the most enjoyable way to lead. Inventing ways to help others grow and thrive is far more fun than conceiving plans for your own private advancement. Beyond that, you'll find that serving others makes you more effective as a leader, because it unlocks the essential ingredient for true leadership. Trust. Mark Sanborn nails this. When people know you are interested in their best interest and in helping them meet their needs, they will trust you. It's human nature. And that genuine interest in helping others and making a positive difference is the essence of leadership. The proponents of servant leadership are not simply contemporary leadership thinkers. Speaking over 250 years ago, Jonathan Edwards wrote, "Especially will the spirit of Christian love dispose those that stand in a public capacity, such as that of ministers and magistrates, and all public officers to seek the public good. It will make them watchful against public dangers, and forward to use their powers for the promotion of the public benefit, not being governed by selfish motives in their administration, not seeking only or mainly to enrich themselves or become great, and to advance themselves on the spoils of others, as wicked rulers very often do, but striving to act for the true welfare of all to whom their authority extends." And, on the other hand, Edwards also spoke of the sin of those who, if clothed with authority, carry themselves very injuriously toward those over whom their authority extends, by behaving very assumingly and magisterially and tyrannically toward them. Those whom you lead are not there to serve you. You are there to serve them. This is how Jesus himself led, Matthew 20, verse 28. How could you see your role as being any different? Turn the work over to the team. As we have seen, you cannot give attention to the true tasks of leadership unless you let your team focus on the managing and doing of the work. This is not to say that the leader is to avoid all menial work. Jesus himself showed us that is not the case by washing his disciples' feet before he gave his life on the cross to serve humankind. John 13, verses 12 through 17. But the primary task of the leader is to set direction, align, and motivate, not primarily create plans and do specific work tasks. We don't succeed at the executive level because of additional functional strengths. You have to turn the work over to your team, even if, at first, they can't do it as well as you. For pastors, don't turn over preaching and teaching. It might be tempting for a pastor to think, okay, if my primary task is leadership, then I need to hand off more preaching and teaching so I can focus on leading the staff. This would be a mistake. The focus of the pastoral role is prayer and the ministry of the word, not leading the pastoral staff. That does need to happen, but it is not the primary role of the pastor. The primary role of the pastor is to shepherd, lead, the flock. And this is done mainly through, not apart from, preaching and teaching. The right application of this principle for pastors, then, is not that they should reduce their preaching and teaching load so that they can do more staff leadership and administrative work. Rather, it is that they should reduce their administrative work so they can devote even more time to preaching and teaching. Some people think that pastors are an exception to the importance of leadership. They think that a focus on leadership leads to a pastor taking on the CEO model. This is incorrect. Leadership in the pastoral role is practiced primarily through the ministry of the word and prayer. And thus, pastors are not an exception to the things I am saying on leadership here. Rather, these things actually protect the true nature of the pastoral role. One nuance here. In large churches, there is often an executive pastor who leads the staff, and other pastors fill numerous other roles. Leaders of small group ministries, family discipleship ministries, etc. I am not saying that's bad. The role of the executive pastor, for example, is mainly to lead the staff. I am talking here about the primary preaching and teaching pastor, which includes the senior pastor. Even so, the executive pastor should place a heavy emphasis on preaching and teaching in his contexts as well. Take time to think. A leader needs to take time to step back, get up on the balcony, and reflect. All good leaders do this. They process what has happened, ponder new and better ways to do things, make sure they keep their eye on the big picture, and just plain think. Leadership has a significant reflecting component, and the best leaders tend to be the best thinkers. You need to find your own way to build reflection into your life as a discipline. For many leaders, virtually all downtime automatically becomes thinking time. They are always musing, always having ideas and reflections and questions running through their heads. You might combine thinking with exercising, or, like Jonathan Edwards, go for long walks to spend time in prayer and thought. The key is that you create time to think and do it regularly. I would also suggest that beyond the ordinary time you take to think during the course of a week, that you take a week out every quarter or 6 months to go somewhere secluded and read and reflect on major issues and across a broad range of topics. Bill Gates exemplifies this idea with his famous Think Weeks, during which he takes a 7-day stretch of seclusion to ponder the future of technology and then propagate those thoughts across the Microsoft empire. Now that his efforts are turned primarily toward his foundation, I doubt that his focus is still the future of technology. But what better way to contribute to the solutions for large global problems than to spend a week reading and thinking about new and better ways to address them? And you can do the same for the problems, and most of all, opportunities, in your organization. One other word here. Don't merely think. Draw conclusions. That's the point of thinking. Those who ponder, ponder, and ponder some more without ever coming to a position on things will be ill-equipped to bring much insight and help to others. Connect. Leaders need not only time to think, but time to connect with people. This should be a top priority for you in your leadership. You need to connect not only with the people in your organization or primary sphere of influence, but also with people all across your industry or movement or marketplace or area. Leaders need to stay in close touch with the people they serve and develop networks of relationships with other leaders. Conferences are a great time to combine taking time to think and connecting with others. And by combing these two areas, they both become more effective because you are able to share your ideas and see how they are refined and built on by others. And this, in fact, is the purpose of conferences, to connect with others and share ideas. Some people regard attending conferences as a bonus expense, as something to do if some extra money is in the budget, but not worth prioritizing otherwise. I couldn't disagree more. The value that comes from making connections, having time to think, being exposed to great new ideas, and refining your ideas is invaluable. If you work for a nonprofit or a church, you will find that conferences radically expand your ability to accomplish your mission. And if you work in business, a strong case can be made that attending good conferences is actually revenue generating. Don't ignore the condition of your soul. There are a lot of parallels between productivity and leadership. As we saw before, both should be focused on the good of others. Another parallel is that character is at the heart of both. Andy Stanley gets this right when he points out that without character, you won't be a leader worth following. Character provides the moral authority necessary to bring together the people and resources needed to further an enterprise. Character is the source of your moral authority. Thus, you need to keep your walk with God vibrant and growing. As Stanley says, to become a leader worth following, you must be intentional about developing the inner man. You must invest in the health of your soul. Nobody plans to fail, especially leaders. But to ignore the condition of your soul is the equivalent of planning to fail. So don't plan to fail. Be intentional about the condition of your soul, which starts with consistent prayer and reading of the Bible, along with fellowship in a good church. Join the movement. What will happen if you can get unstuck? You will, of course, be able to get more done with less stress and frustration. You will be able to manage your time more deliberately, increase your energy, and build great momentum in your work and life. You will have greater peace of mind with greater impact. But don't stop there. Remember the unstuck cycle. The ultimate purpose of getting unstuck is to serve others, especially by helping them get unstuck. This is the most fulfilling way to live, and it is what God calls us to. So use your increased productivity to do good for others in more effective and creative ways. Do this for those in your workplace, your community, and especially your family. Don't just use your increased effectiveness for your own benefit. Use it to bring great benefit to others, even through obstacles. The best way to make this happen is to join up with others. You can't get unstuck alone or use your effectiveness for the greatest good without collaboration, interaction, and friendship with those in a common cause. The good news is that there is a growing movement of people who are excited about making a difference in their work, communities, and families through greater effectiveness. These people are not just hardworking, but are also smart and creative. And they are everywhere. Find these people, both right around you and online, and join up with them. Work together, share ideas, and collaborate. Get to know these people in your workplace, community, and church who believe in making a difference and get going on projects together. Share productivity practices, form groups, organize initiatives that make a difference. As you do this in very simple ways with people who share your interests, you join the movement of people who are making a difference in creative, fulfilling ways in the world. And as you join this movement, using your increased effectiveness to make a difference for good together, the world can change. You can advance the common good, tackle large global problems like extreme poverty, and further the spread of the gospel. You can avoid a life that is just marking time and lived for yourself. You can make a difference in a balanced, interdependent way by joining up with the thousands of others who are already learning about getting things done for the good of others. And you can start by talking to just one person.
You've been listening to the audio production of How to Get Unstuck. Text copyright 2018 by Matt Perman. Production copyright 2018 by Zondervan. No portion of this recording may be reproduced without the prior written consent of the publisher. For more information on other books and audio products from Zondervan, please visit your favorite retailer or visit us online at zondervan.com. How to Get Unstuck was recorded at Paragon Studios in Franklin, Tennessee.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.